Today we're going to deal with an issue here that I hope we can glean some things from because they have everything to do with your life, speaking particularly of relational conflict. If you're a person and sinful, then this is inevitable. So I think that's everybody. Did we get everybody? You're human and you have a sinful nature. So you're going to experience relational conflict. And I decided to go to the book of Job because, I don't know, that seems to be the go-to book in my Bible for relational conflict. You know, there's many things you could pull out of the book of Job. Spiritual warfare, plenty of that going on there. There's lessons on suffering, and we all know that Job is a good one for suffering, but I might suggest that the book of Job is about arguing, because by sheer content, there's 35 chapters of an argument there going on that you and I get to eavesdrop in on. I don't know how that got recorded. Maybe there was a stenograph machine there, and one of them was a court reporter and just taking notes. And Job, back up a second. What was that you said about wanting to die? Did I get that right? Okay, good. Move on. And recording every bit of this argument that takes place between a man and his closest associates for the course of 35 chapters. I don't know that there's anything else in the Bible that lasts for 35 chapters. So here we've got this idea of relational conflict, and as I've already said, you're going to experience this in your life, and so we have a lot to learn. You're going to experience relational conflict in many of the areas that Job did, perhaps between a parent and children. Job was a father with sons and daughters. And without reading the entire book for you, I'll tell you the cliff notes. He had children who were really into house parties. They were kind of fraternity, sorority boys and girls, and they got together, it says, to eat and drink. And then Job would, of course, get up in the morning and offer sacrifices to atone for their sins, because he knew that some things might have gone down that night at the house that shouldn't have been there. So there was relational conflict with his kids. We can read in the book of Job the relational conflict between a husband and wife, and we don't get 35 chapters, we get like one or two verses. Curse God and die, she tells her husband. And there's plenty to read into that, but we're not going to do that this morning. But suffice it to say, there is relational conflict with all kinds of people that you have around you, whether it be family, whether it be friends, associates, business partners, co-workers, strangers, fellow freeway drivers. They're everywhere, aren't they? And relational conflict is something that is going to bombard you. And I'm hoping that in our course of study this morning, we can learn how to navigate that bombardment without destruction. So, naturally speaking, I'd like to say that we're more likely to endure family discord than we are conflict among our peers. I don't know if you would agree with me on this, but I would say that this would be true, isn't it? That we sometimes have conflict within families that we're much more likely to find resolve for, because being that they're family, we can't get away. You just have to learn how to deal with him because he's there. If you have brothers and sisters, you grew up in the same home, it was some occasional fighting. You're like, not us. Yes, it was. You fought, but you didn't leave them, and you didn't disown them. Yet when it comes to conflict among peers, and I can say this speaking from what I've seen, we're much more likely to abandon our peers. I've seen it happen where we've been associated with somebody that we would consider to be a good friend and for upwards of a decade, and then when there's conflict that we quickly consider as unbearable, I'm out of here, I don't need this, and you can't treat me that way, and so I can abandon you, never to see you again. In fact, speaking ill will of you in your absence. And so it oftentimes seems, and maybe rightly so, that there's a stronger bond between family than there is between peers, but I don't know that that's appropriate, because Jesus seemed to have a tighter bond between his peers than even his own family. And you might say, I don't know where you're getting that. Well, I'm getting it from the Bible, where Jesus' family shows up to church, and they're trying to get him out, and he says, I'm in here with my... Who's my mother and my father and my sisters and my brothers? They're right here. It's the ones who do the will of God, thus indicating a stronger bond with those who were Christians alongside of him, serving God and fighting for his kingdom, rather than those who were connected to him by flesh and blood. And yet we have this wrong so often in the church, might I add, to our shame, where the weakest of the relationships we have are with other Christians. I'll pull bits and pieces from the book of Job as we go, but again, it's a real long book, and I'm not going to read through a whole lot of it, but I'm going to sift through and take bits and pieces out of this. And if you're not... My apologies if you're unfamiliar with the book of Job. Just start reading now, and by the time I'm done, maybe you'll be finished. Then you'll know what I'm kind of talking about. But the book of Job starts with this behind-the-scenes glimpse into the spiritual world, where for these first two chapters, we get this idea that there's some spiritual communication going on between controlling forces. I'm being very nebulous here because we'll get to this as we go. And then suddenly, Job and his friends are roped into this circumstantial chaos that becomes the focal point of the conversation for the next 35 chapters. The last several chapters, some interesting things happen where we'll get to that. And then the book closes with one single chapter that tells us how it all panned out in the end. So we're going to start here by speaking on the nature of the relationship that Job had with these associates. And I've been calling them associates thus far because I didn't want to give myself away. If you don't know, they're actually his friends. So the nature of the relationship that Job has with those in which he's conflict with is a friendship relationship. The Bible says here that they are his friends in chapter 2, verse 11. And then by the time you get to the end of the book, in chapter 42, God even refers to these men as friends. So it's recognized, this friendship. They're personal friends. It gives us their names. Eliphaz, we can call him Eli. Bildad, Bill. And Zophar. I don't know, Zophar, I guess. You can't go Zoe, it's a guy. So Zophar and Bill and Eli, these are his closest friends. And I would say if we read into this, and I'm not trying to be extra biblical here, I'm just trying to read into what the text gives us. It says that they're friends. And if you look up the Hebrew, which I did, just to be careful, it means what you think it means. Friends. Friends, right? We know what friends are. Friends are people you go on vacation with. Friends are chosen based on, get this, based on the absence of tension. Okay? Friends are chosen based on the absence of tension. If you bring a lot of tension to my life, you're not going to be one of my closest friends. Is that fair to say? Like, there's the guy at work where every time you go to work, he's just got that personality that doesn't match yours, and you're like, ugh, but you're on the line next to him, so you got to put up with him. But when you go home afterwards, you don't call him up and go, you want to come over this weekend? We're going to barbecue. Not unless you're witnessing, right? It's like, I have to do this because if I don't, I'm going to try and establish a relationship here, but he's not really exactly one of my closest circle. And you're like, well, that's not very nice. I mean, to kind of put people on a tier like that, and well, I like some better than others. Listen, Jesus did that. Peter, James, and John, you can read through the Gospels, they were closer to him than anybody. They got kind of like this backstage pass into some of the coolest things that Jesus did in his ministry. And then you've got the 11. Okay, I'm excluding one on purpose. But the 11, and they're pretty close too, but not like Peter, James, and John. Then you got the 70, and they're pretty cool, but they're not close as the 11. And then you got the 120, and then you got the multitudes, and then you got the Pharisees. And you get, there's a tiered sort of aspect there. So I think that their relationship was pretty relaxed. They could kick back and hang out. There wasn't a lot of tension in that relationship. Secondly, I think the nature of the relationship was one of maturity. I think that they had been friends for a long time. I don't think that they had just recently become acquainted with one another. And I say this because if what happened to Job happened to you, you'd be pretty selective of who gets to come over. Like, you're in the hospital, dying. All your kids are dead. Houses are blown over. All of your sheep got electrocuted with lightning. People killed all your associates, your servants, your employees. all of your assets are gone, your investments have failed, your property's foreclosed, somebody stole your credit card and drained you. Like, it's just worse piling on. And now Job is laying in his hospital bed. There's very few people that are granted access into that room, right? Listen, if I'm there, I like you guys, but if that's me, there's a lot of you that don't get to come in. Very few people have access to me at that point. I don't want you to see me like this, and I don't want to see you while I'm like this. Right? And so who gets to show up? These three friends. And by the way, Job's own brothers and sisters don't show up until this is all over. So his own brothers and sisters aren't there. And it says his acquaintances showed up. Acquaintances afterwards. But his truest friends, the ones with whom he had the most mature relationship, the most well-established friendship, they were there. Third, a respect of opinion. And I say this because these events in Job are really old. Most commentaries believe that what happened in Job happened before Genesis 12, where we meet Abraham. This is all pre-Abraham. And if it's pre-Abraham, it means it's pre-law. It means it's pre, it happened before, well before New Testament, and well before a lot of the Old Testament. This means they had no Bible. Job and his friends had no Bible. And they were just trying to figure things out about God as they went along in their friendship. You ever do that? You did it before you were saved, right? You'd get high or drunk, and you'd just, all of a sudden, the conversation just shifts to God, because that's what you're doing when you're high and drunk. If anybody... It's okay to laugh. That's what you do. Did anybody go to college? That's what you do. And so these guys are working out their theology with one another, because that's what you do before you have a Bible. And I would say that they got it a lot closer than I did before I had a Bible. Okay? So these guys are working out theology. That means that they have a deep respect for one another. And you know that they were hammering out their theology with one another because those 35 chapters where they're arguing, there's a lot of theology being brought up. Well, God isn't like that. And Job's like, God is too like that. And I don't know what else to tell you. We talked about this before. Look at the transcripts. There was a lot of God talk. And they were coming to the deepest of conclusions about the most important matters in life with one another. The fourth one concerning the nature of the relationship, that was a relaxed relationship, it was a mature relationship, they had known each other for a long time. There was a deep respect of opinion there. And I would also say that it was a safety. It was just a safe friendship. Okay? Job's friends weren't miscreants, you know. The Bible says that Job was like more blameless and upright than anybody on the planet. Okay? So I don't think Job was hanging around with, you know, like thieves and, you know, these guys are right up there with him. And so these guys are safe, which would have made it probably a little more painful, a little less expectant when this kind of stuff kind of started to unfold. It's like, man, I felt safe around you guys, and now you're just lambasting me when I'm at my worst. Thanks. So their relationship was one of close camaraderie. And so if we can gather something from this, I would say to you that you can expect to have great conflict with those between whom you have the greatest spiritual kinship, respect, and trust. The greatest spiritual kinship, respect, and trust. And you know what? For a lot of you, that's going to be the people you're sitting next to right here in this church. So this relational conflict isn't something that's happening out there, you guys. It's not happening at work. This is happening in the church. We're speaking specifically of relational conflict in the church. I'd like to speak about the cause of the conflict. You guys know what the cause of the conflict is? If you've read the book of Job, you know that things go terrible after terrible. Like, I can read it for you. It says in chapter 1, verse 13, we start where it says, "Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house." So they're having a frat party again. "And a messenger comes to Job, and he says, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabians raided them, took them away, and indeed they have killed the servants and with the edge of the sword. and I alone have escaped to tell you. That alone is a bad day, but it gets worse. While he was still speaking, get that, while he was still speaking, another dude barges in, interrupting the conversation, and says, the fire of God fell from heaven. I don't know what that is. Lightning? Sulfur? Forest fire? And it burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, incredible. And this is factual, okay? While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans, bad guys, formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. At this point, Job is going, I am ruined. I have nothing left. Oh, wait, yes, I do have something left. I've still got my kids. And when things go bad, don't we kind of resort to that? Well, at least we got each other. But look at what happens in verse 18. While he was still speaking, another came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came across the wilderness, struck the four corners of the house. It fell on the young people. They're all dead. I'm the only one that has escaped to tell you. And by the way, they were in sin when they died. Job had no chance to rewind time and offer them a sacrifice on their behalf to atone perhaps for their sins, or at least in Job's mind, cover their iniquity before they perished and had to face God in judgment. This has just gone from bad to worse, to whatever's worse than worse, to whatever's beyond that. Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshiped, and he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Pretty good attitude, considering the circumstances. And verse 22 says, in all this, Job didn't sin or charge God with wrong, which is a lot more demonstrative of his integrity than, I don't want to say me, but I don't want to say you either. Some people who can't even endure an 85-degree day. I mean, we just went through one of the worst winters on record, and now it's going to start warming up. And I swear to you, as soon as we hit 85, 90, people are going to be like, God, it's hot out here. It's like, what do you want? 30 below? You want to go back to that? Shut up, or my judgment is coming. My Lord, the glacier in my backyard is just finally kind of melted away. He doesn't charge God with any wrong. So you get that the cause of the conflict is a lot of circumstantial stuff, right? His kids are dead. That would bring conflict into at least emotional turmoil. But when you're in emotional turmoil, does that not start to affect the people around you, your relationships with, you know, like, well, what's the matter with you? Well, my kids all died. Really? On the same day? Yes, all on the same day. It's like, okay, I understand. I'll give you a break. Job lost everything. And so you look at the circumstantial cause, and that seems to be obvious. He's lost everything except for his faith and his life. Because if you don't think it could get worse, it does. He's stricken then with a disease in chapter 2 that's bringing him to the brink of death, and yet he's hanging on but barely. He's got his faith and he's got his life, and both of those two are right now in serious jeopardy, aren't they? He has every opportunity to give up on God. And physically speaking, he's looking at death in the face. So we get the obvious cause of the conflict. But there's a secondary cause here that in the first two chapters is revealed to us, where we see that Satan had something to do with it. And you're like, aha, I knew he was back there somewhere. Yes, in this case, he was. The Bible explains it like this. There was a day when the sons of God, angels, came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came with them. And the Lord says to Satan, from where do you come? Where you been? So Satan answers the Lord and says, from going to and fro on the earth and walking back and forth on it. Real generic answer. I just been down there doing stuff. Like God doesn't know. Verse 8 blows my mind. God then turns to Satan and says, have you considered my servant Job? If you could peer into the supernatural realm and eavesdrop in on a conversation that God is having with Satan and your name comes up, run, run! Have you considered my servant Justin? I'd be like, I'd be like, God, he has. It's, we're done. We're done. Leave me alone. And yet God brings him up. Have you considered my servant Job? He's blameless, upright man. There's no one like him on the planet. I mean, that's crazy. So then Satan says, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him? Like, you know, there's that prayer. Lord, your hedge of protection. And Satan brings that up too, doesn't he? Well, doesn't he just have your hedge of protection? I mean, he has no choice but to be happy in the Lord. Look at him. He's got more camels and more donkeys and more sheep than anybody. He's got servants galore. He's doing awesome. He's fit and trim. Listen, God, you let me prove my point, and I'll show you up. I'll show you that Job isn't made of what you think he's made out of. Let me take his sheep and his donkeys. Let me take everything he has. Let me kill a few people that he knows. Let me take his health. And you watch what happens, God. He will curse you to your face, and we'll see what he's made out of. And so what's Satan's objective in all of this behind-the-scenes stuff? Satan wants to prove himself right before God. That's where all of this conflict comes from. Satan wanting to prove himself right. You know that it was before this that Satan was proven wrong. He fell from heaven. The Bible says that God kicked him out of the heavenly congregation. Excommunication. And now he wants to vindicate himself, doesn't he? Before that heavenly congregation. Well, you give me the chance and I'll prove that God and your whole church is wrong. And so God, knowing the faith that he gave Job, says, go ahead and test him. Because I know the solid, undefiled nature of the faith that I give a person. So you go ahead and test him, and then you will see that he cannot be brought down, no matter how terrible the calamity. So Satan takes him up on it, and of course, we'll go ahead and do that. And so now the scene unfolds, and we have the obvious cause, which is the circumstantial calamity. You've got the secondary cause, which is Satan working behind the scenes. But listen to me, guys. This is something that I think we all know but would like to forget and sometimes willfully do. The ultimate cause behind all of it, even Satan, is God. God actually gave Satan permission to do everything that he did in the life of Job. That's troubling, isn't it? I mean, isn't God the one who's like, well, have you considered so-and-so? They're doing really awesome at church, leading a family and serving his wife and kids, and he's doing really well for himself vocationally, and go ruin him. Well, what if that's you? You're on top of your game right now. Some of you, you may not be on top of your game, and this would speak into your life, but listen, others of you, you may be on top of your game. So just be prepared for the possibility that tomorrow you may not be. You've heard it said before, and it bears repeating, that your life could change with a phone call. You've heard that one before. Your cell phone rings, you answer it, and somebody you love, somebody out there, they just died. This is what happened to Job, isn't it? And God is behind the entire thing. So I would say to you that Satan, or some strategy that he initiated, I don't know, because you can't go and say, well, then Satan's behind everything. No, Satan's not behind everything, but he develops certain strategies where he can do greater work in the lives of multiple people at once. So either Satan or a strategy that he's initiated may be a certain factor in the relational conflict of your experience. But perhaps that's not the case. I don't want you to blame everything that happens to you on Satan. That could be dangerous. Some people do that. They think Satan's behind everything. No, not everything. But on the other side of that, I don't want you to pretend that he's never a factor, because that could be equally damaging. Because if you don't think that Satan's behind some of the stuff that's getting into your head between you and another brother or sister, you're bound to think that it's the brother or sister that's the devil, and not the devil. But what does the Bible say? We don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. So it's ultimately the devil that is wanting to destroy your relationships. So if you got something with me, it ain't me, guys. And if I got something against you, it's not you. We need to work through this for the sake of Christ, remembering that Satan seeks to destroy. Satan is in favor of testifying, or of testing, rather, the relationships that you have with your friends at church. But please remember that so is God. If God isn't in favor of allowing your relationships to be tested, God would have put a stop to it for Job before it even began. So you've got the nature of the relationship is just some of the best that you could ever imagine. I mean, these guys are great. They're friends. They have trust between one another. There's this cause of the conflict. And then the third point here, the danger of the discord. And I'm being pastoral, like, you know, here's a little sermonette, danger of the discord, the point number three. Hopefully it helps you organize your thoughts. Third point, the danger of the discord. What's the danger of allowing these kinds of relationships to go unresolved? There's two. There's a personal danger. On an individual level, what can happen? Well, first of all, I want to go to the very last part of the book of Job, draw your attention to what begins in chapter 38 and continues on, or rather, in chapter 37, you have God answering Job, which to me, if you, again, when you read this, I'll start in verse 38, or verse 1 of chapter 38, just so you get the nature of this three-chapter rebuke. It says, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Okay, now, you got these guys arguing back and forth for 35 chapters. Job has just gone through absolute hell. And God intervenes and begins with this. He's talking to Job. He says, who is this that darkens my counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. That seems crazy to me. You know, we believe in a God of love. We believe in a God of compassion. And yet here we have God, after all of this has happened to Job, going, Job, suck it up. We're going to have a conversation. I'm going to address you, so prepare yourself like a man. When somebody says that to you, somebody with authority, you know you got it coming. It's like, can I take a rain check on this conversation? I'm on my deathbed, and a lot of bad things have happened to me lately, so if we could talk about this later. And God's like, no, we're talking about this now, and I've got a line of questions. And then for several chapters in a row, God is just going after him. Where were you when I made rock badgers, and where does lightning come from? Come on! And Job's like, I don't know. Yeah, I did. I knew you didn't know. Well, shut up! I got more questions. It's like, yeah. Job's like, man. And so then by the end of this, Job is just, if he couldn't have been any more humbled, he is now. And he finally goes, God, I'm sorry. And now, I'm wondering, why would God do that? You ever wonder, why would God do that? Why would he just end this whole thing with 3-4 chapters yelling? I would suggest to you that there is such a danger that Job is in, even after all of this, that God had to deal with him in this way to rescue him from that danger. Well, what's the danger? Self-pity. Job is in extreme danger right now of self-pity, carrying over something that has already done, something that happened in the past, with him into his current life, using it as justification for current sin. Isn't that what we do with self-pity? Something that happened in the past becomes my excuse for why I'm living the way I'm living. Well, I know what I'm doing isn't right, but let me tell you a few things about my childhood. I was abused and beaten, and I've suffered this, and I've suffered that, and you don't know what it's like. So just get off my back about the sin I'm committing right now. And by the way, feel some sympathy for me, too, because I just gave you a really good sob story. This is happening all the time, this sort of victim mentality. And if God didn't come after Job like that, I dare say he would lose his status as the most blameless and upright. Because now he's full of self-pity. If you want to take a look at what self-pity can do for somebody, read the life of Saul in the Old Testament. This guy was full of himself, full of self-pity. He started out really good. And then pretty soon he's like, well, what is all this? David killed his tens of thousands stuff. I'm awesome too. People don't recognize that I'm awesome. How come they're writing pop songs about him and they're not writing pop songs about me? I am the king. And he just downward spiral, introspective, self-absorbed, and then it ends in suicide. Too much self-pity. There's also a corporate danger. There's an individual danger. There's also a corporate danger. In Hebrews chapter 12, it says, pursue peace with all, looking carefully lest any root of bitterness springing up causes trouble. And by this, many become defiled. You know what can happen in the church? Is there's a root of bitterness that starts with somebody. There's this personal conflict going on. It isn't resolved. It continues to grow, and it defiles people that weren't even part of the original conflict. Right? You ever seen that one? Like, I'm not a bad gardener if I got weeds in my garden. That's going to happen, isn't it? Personal conflict is going to happen. But I am a bad gardener if I keep them in the garden. I am a bad gardener if I water them and fertilize the weeds. If you have bitterness in your heart towards somebody else, you should resolve the conflict. You're not a bad Christian because somebody bothers you. You are a bad Christian when you won't deal with it and you continue to feed it, obsess over it, dwell on it, pray for death over that person. Come on, guys, can't do that. Deal with interpersonal conflict. There's a personal danger and a corporate danger. Discord destroys. And the Bible tells us that God hates people who sow discord. You're like, God hates? Yep. According to Proverbs 16 through 19, it says that God hates a person who stirs up conflict in the community. That's the New International Version. God hates people who sows discord among family. New Living. God hates people who sows discord among brothers. That's the ESV. So you got God hates people who stirs up conflict in the community, in the family, among brothers. Just God can't stand discord. So what are the results then of reconciliation? We finally get to the very end of the book in chapter 42 and you read about how things turned out. It actually turns out really good. So the book of Job isn't an entire bummer. He gets everything back in the end and then some. It says that his assets actually doubled in verse 10 of chapter 42. So he does pretty well for himself in the end. It says in verse 13 that he has like seven sons and several daughters, which so I guess apparently he reconciled with his wife, right? So things are okay there. And I want you to notice that it was contingent upon the relationship that he had with his friends. It says that God spoke to the three men and had them go back to Job for prayer. And it says that God says, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends for you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. In verse 8 it says, now therefore take for yourselves seven bulls and seven rams. Go to my servant Job and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering. And my servant Job shall pray for you. I will accept him. And I will deal with you according to your folly because what you have spoken of me is not right as my servant Job has. So they did that. And it says in verse 10 that the Lord restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. It happened when he prayed for his friends. Not until he prayed for his friends, but when he prayed for his friends. And so God blesses reconciliation. He is looking for this because without reconciliation, you're disconnected from the family of God, and it's through the family of God that we receive God's blessings. In Genesis 12, God speaks to Abraham, and he sets out this principle that says, blessed are those who bless you, and cursed are those who curse you. You can see that there is a direct relation between our connection with the family of God and the blessing we receive. And so when we remove ourselves from that, we in some way, and on some level, remove ourselves from the blessing of God. God is particularly interested in reconciliation because he loves your opponent just as much as he loves you. This isn't just about me when I'm in a conflict with somebody. This is about them as well. Secondly, God's interested in blessing the both of us. And thirdly, God is interested in receiving glory through that relationship. When conflict is resolved, God is glorified. Colossians 3:13 says, "Bear with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgive each other as the Lord has forgiven you." When we work things out between you and I, it's reflective of what God has done for us through Christ. If you think about Christ going to the cross, you can remember that the most devastating blows that Jesus received on Calvary, we're talking both physical and spiritual, he absorbed those for the sake of reconciliation, didn't he? Right? Every whip that landed on his back and every fist that struck his face and all of the physical pain he absorbed, not to mention the wrath of God as he hung on the cross. All of that was absorbed so that reconciliation between us and God was possible. And if that kind of challenge was met by Christ, is it going to be any different for his followers? Could we expect any less pain, so to speak, in dealing with interpersonal conflict right here with brothers, knowing that reconciliation comes at a price? And I know it hurts, doesn't it? I mean, imagine this conflict between Job and his friends. You want me to go and make sacrifice? You want me to pray for them? They weren't there for me, man. These guys were out of line, God. You pray for them. Doesn't the Bible say that Jesus kind of intercedes? He can do it. The Bible tells us here clearly that we are to love our brothers even when there's conflict. And I'll close with this. And if the music team wants to come up and do one last song, the idea of conflict among believers seems to be an ongoing issue, obvious for obvious reasons. But my fear is that in refusing to or failing to deal with it appropriately, we're continuing to see casualties. And there are people that aren't here anymore that were a year ago. And I dare say it's because of unresolved relational conflict, dealing with it inappropriately, casting blame, ridicule, and scorn on one another. And I pray that as we read God's word, that we would understand clearly that God is a God of reconciliation. So my prayer for you, here's my hope, is that if I get to come back and do this again next May, you're all here. And that for the next year, when there's problems, you deal with those problems. Because you can expect that there may be some that float to the surface every once in a while with those that you have the greatest trust for, the greatest spiritual kinship with. That could include your pastors and elders. You know that, right? Do you deal with it appropriately? Or do you keep sweeping it under the rug until the rug is several feet off the ground and you have no choice but to look at the dirt you've been sweeping underneath? Well, I love you guys, and it's been my pleasure to speak with you this morning. After church, we're going to have prayer up here. And if anybody needs prayer, maybe this would be a good time to take care of some of those kinds of issues you've had. Please make good on the opportunity. Let's all stand.